This is Hacker Daily for Friday, June 1st, and today we're talking about how to get rich without getting lucky, invisible asymptotes, and four thoughts about better MVPs. I'm Dave Zorob.
And I'm Harish Agarwal.
Thanks for tuning in to Hacker Daily, featuring top stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Please remember to subscribe and rate us on your podcast app.
The following is a tweet storm by Naval Ravikant, a noted angel investor, on how to get rich without getting lucky. Seek wealth, not money or status. Wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep. Money is how we transfer time and wealth. Status is your place in the social hierarchy. Understand that ethical wealth creation is possible. If you secretly despise wealth, it will elude you. Ignore people playing status games. They gain status by attacking people playing wealth creation games. You're not going to get rich renting out your time. You must own equity, a piece of business, to gain your financial freedom. You will get rich by giving society what it wants, but does not yet know how to get, at scale. Pick an industry where you can play long-term games with long-term people. The internet has massively broadened the possible space of careers. Most people haven't figured this out yet. Play iterated games. All the returns in life, whether in wealth, relationships, or knowledge, come from compound interest. Pick business partners with high intelligence, energy, and above all, integrity. Don't partner with cynics and pessimists. Their beliefs are self-fulfilling. Learn to sell. Learn to build. If you can do both, you will be unstoppable. Arm yourself with specific knowledge, accountability, and leverage. Specific knowledge is knowledge that you cannot be trained for. If society can train you, it can train someone else and replace you. Specific knowledge is found by pursuing your genuine curiosity and passion, rather than whatever is hot right now. Building specific knowledge will feel like play to you, but will look like work to others. When specific knowledge is taught, it's through apprenticeships, not schools. Specific knowledge is often highly technical or creative. It cannot be outsourced or automated. Embrace accountability and take business risks under your own name. Society will reward you with responsibility, equity, and leverage. The most accountable people have singular, public, and risky brands: Oprah, Trump, Kanye, Elon. A quote from Archimedes: "Give me a lever long enough and a place to stand, and I will move the earth." Fortunes require leverage. Business leverage comes from capital, people, and products with no marginal cost of replication, code, and media. Capital means money. To raise money, apply your specific knowledge with accountability and show resulting good judgment. Labor means people working for you. It's the oldest and most fought over form of leverage. Labor leverage will impress your parents, but don't waste your life chasing it. Capital and labor are permissioned leverage. Everyone is chasing capital, but someone has to give it to you. Everyone is trying to lead, but someone has to follow you. Code and media are permissionless leverage. They're the leverage behind the newly rich. You can create software and media that works for you while you sleep. An army of robots is freely available. It's just packed in data centers for heat and space efficiency. Use it. If you can't code, write books and blogs, record videos and podcasts. Leverage is a force multiplier for your judgment. Judgment requires experience, but can be built faster by learning foundational skills. There is no skill called business. Avoid business magazines and business classes. Study microeconomics, game theory, psychology, persuasion, ethics, mathematics, and computers. Reading is faster than listening. Doing is faster than watching. You should be too busy to do coffee while still keeping an uncluttered calendar. Set and enforce an aspirational personal hourly rate. If fixing a problem will save less than your hourly rate, ignore it. If outsourcing a task will cost less than your hourly rate, outsource it. Work as hard as you can, even though who you work with and what you work on are more important than how hard you work. Become the best in the world at what you do. Keep redefining what you do until this is true. There are no get-rich-quick schemes. That's just someone else getting rich off you. Apply specific knowledge with leverage, and eventually you will get what you deserve. When you're finally wealthy, you'll realize that it wasn't what you were seeking in the first place. But that's for another day.
Today, we like to discuss a story by Eugene Wei, who's a former Amazon employee. He wrote a blog post that went pretty viral on Twitter, as well as Hacker News, called Invisible Asymptotes. Well, that's like a pretty specific term. So what's an invisible asymptote? It's a ceiling that our growth curve would bump its head against if we continued down our current path. And Eugene goes on to say that for Amazon, finding the invisible asymptote was pretty easy. So all they did was survey existing customers after they ordered, asking, why don't you purchase more often from Amazon? Just a simple text field. And then for people who had never shopped with Amazon, they hired a third-party firm that conducted a market research survey where they'd asked those people why they didn't shop from Amazon. So the answer from both of them was very clear and straightforward, and perhaps not surprising. It was shipping fees. And Eugene says, quote, people hate paying for shipping. They despise it. People don't just hate paying for shipping. They hate it to literally an irrational degree, end quote. He goes on to talk about how Amazon tried all these experiments showing that, you know, even with the shipping fees added onto the order, you would save money because the books are cheaper than at your local bookstore. And at the time, you probably wouldn't pay sales tax either. So if you add it all up, it's still cheaper than going to the bookstore, but people would still be so mad about paying for the shipping fee that they wouldn't complete the order. And so reducing shipping fees became the highest priority for everyone across Amazon. It was easy to align all the product teams around reducing shipping fees. The first attempt to do that was called Super Saver Shipping. Try saying that three times fast. That feature is actually still around on Amazon. It's a way to, if you hit a minimum order size, I think it's $25, that you can get free shipping on your order. But unfortunately, this had some second order effects that weren't super great. It encouraged people to batch up their orders and wait until they had $25 in their cart before ordering. So the next thing they tried was the famous Amazon Prime. And as Eugene says, the rest is history. They didn't even test it that much before rolling it out. They basically just said, okay, we're going to try this experiment. This is going to be awesome. And it was. So Amazon Prime solved for the invisible asymptote. Basically, people would think that they're not paying for shipping at all, even though, of course, they're paying whatever it is, $8 or $9 a month, and now maybe $10 a month. So I think it might be helpful to look at asymptotes from other companies as well. So Eugene covers a few in his blog post, and we're going to talk about a few more as well. So let's start with Twitter. The early theory is that Twitter was like Facebook. Basically, Facebook had this very famous theory from their growth team. If you friended a certain number of people, I think I've heard any number from 7 or 10 or 30, and then you would be an active user, you'd be hooked into Facebook, and you'd see the value. So Twitter has always tried something similar, which is getting people to follow other people as part of their onboarding. But ultimately, it doesn't really seem to have helped growth. Eugene's theory is that basically Twitter has hit an invisible asymptote already because the core experience of Twitter has reached almost everyone in the world who would actually like it. Basically, he says the problem is that for those who don't use Twitter, almost all of its ideal attributes among the early adopter cohort are those which other people find bewildering and unattractive. So many people find the text-heavy nature of Twitter to be a turnoff, actually maybe the majority of people, he says. His proposal for how Twitter might have gotten around that invisible asymptote, the asymptote being that there's only so many people in the world who are addicted to information and are obsessed with this kind of text-based info sharing. Eugene says that maybe if Twitter hadn't turned off its third-party APIs for creating Twitter clients, that other people maybe could have created new products that might bring new users to the platform. It's often surmised that Twitter did this because they wanted to control their monopoly on ad placement in the client. But there are probably other ways that they could have done that with third-party clients.
Right. At the time, some people may not remember this, but there was at one point a pretty vibrant third-party API client ecosystem. In fact, when I first started using Twitter, it wasn't directly via Twitter. It was through a client. I know plenty of people who did the same. Slowly, Twitter started killing off those API clients, and the ecosystem just kind of died. I don't really know of that many folks who are building viable businesses on top of Twitter's API. Instead, what seems to have happened is people will use Twitter's sort of like single use case API, or at least that's what I would call it, for embedding tweets in other content. So if you're embedding a tweet in an article, in a news article, which happens a lot today because Twitter seems to be a platform that many public figures will use, you can fall back on the Twitter API to do that. But what Eugene Wei is saying is that it hasn't transition to the point where people are building new clients on top of the Twitter protocol, where what he means by the protocol is the follower graph, where you can follow someone without them following you back and consume their content, and where folks will essentially broadcast their messages via a short character limit message stream. So that hasn't really turned into anything outside of Twitter.com.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that was actually an intentional move. There were other clients that were fairly vibrant, but Twitter has slowly, over the course of many years, completely cut those out of the ecosystem. And now I think the change is happening at the end of this month, where third-party clients won't even be able to automatically refresh their feeds or receive any kind of push notification for new activity from Twitter. So it's been a pretty clear decision to cut off these clients. But my question is, like, would it actually have helped? Like, it's hard to, operate in like a counterfactual universe here. We don't know what would have happened, but I can't imagine that. It's hard for me to imagine a new experience that would have brought new people onto the platform without like fundamentally changing the Twitter experience.
I would agree. The attributes that Eugene talks about, which I tend to agree with when I see it outlined like that, the text-heavy nature, which is, according to him, a turnoff for many people, totally believe that. The another thing he mentions is the fact that you sort of have to mine Twitter for gems. You kind of have to actively read your feed to find the bits of information that are worthwhile.
And you have to choose who to follow, right?
Exactly. Like
and I think that what Twitter does now when you sign up is basically try to get you to follow Kanye West and Donald Trump. And sure, while a lot of people might be theoretically interested in the stuff they have to say, it doesn't really offer the same kind of experience that you or I might have on Twitter, or any like powered Twitter user would have, which is right. A pretty highly curated feed of stuff that really only I would be interested in this exact mix of things.
Right. So it's not clear that a different product built on top of the same protocol would solve the Twitter problem. I suppose Eugene's argument is that the completely stalled or seemingly stalled from the outside product dev velocity of Twitter, maybe that could have been solved by enabling third-party developers to build new things. But it's just not clear what you build on top of that protocol to change those fundamental attributes and remove the invisible asymptote.
So let's move on to Facebook. Facebook obviously has a much larger user base than Twitter. At one point, there was some kind of competition directly between them, which is kind of funny to think about in retrospect. Facebook worked really hard to make their news feed much more real-time like Twitter's was. And really, the problems that Facebook is dealing with are a direct result of the scale that they've achieved, right? With more than 2 billion people on the platform, they're running into a problem where the more people that you're friends with, the less you end up posting. And I've definitely seen that to be the case with my use of Facebook, although I've recently completely deleted my account. At this point, when you log into a Facebook feed, what I would see is weird posts from like random high school friends and kind of not so immediate family versus what it used to be used for. Everyone I know posting, hey, we're going to this party tonight or something like that. Maybe it's just because I'm old, but there's definitely a problem with once you have 300, 500, 1,000 Facebook friends, the idea that everything you post is going to go out to 1,000 people, that's kind of a pretty high bar for putting something online.
It also makes it harder to be motivated to author original content or offer up personal details about yourself. And it is no surprise that at this point, at least when I was using Facebook, and I've gone down the same path as Dave, where I don't use it anymore, I've deleted it. The primary content that I would consume on Facebook was articles that friends would repost or share. It was very rare that I would see anyone authoring any original content or offering up personal details about their family or photos, which is really why I was interested in Facebook to begin with, and I suspect many people are interested to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we think about Facebook and Twitter and these other platforms as a kind of game, and you can think about them that way because the mechanics that they expose to their users, whether it's a like button or a retweet or whatever it is, reward certain behaviors, then Facebook has created an environment where there's kind of decreasing returns to posting because anything you post might offend one of your friends. And there are increasing returns to trolling where you might get a lot of feedback, whether that's personal feedback or feedback on the platform for dissing on posts from other people or posting more outrageous content in the sense of trying to get a response from people.
It's basically winning the game of distribution, where if you think about Facebook and Twitter as distribution channels and the reward is to get your content distributed more widely, one end result of Facebook is the more controversial something is that you say or the more extreme it is, the more likely it is that it will be shared or liked or circulated among a cohort of people.
And if we look at Twitter the same way, and Eugene goes into this in pretty big detail on his post, you should check the link in the episode notes. Twitter rewards, because of the character constraints, a certain kind of pithiness, what Eugene calls like a fortune cookie sensibility. Basically, the more followers you have, the more you're incentivized to create these short, supposedly full of wisdom, retweetable, likable snippets of text. His theory is that the more followers you get, the more likely the person's tweets converge on a fortune cookie.
That makes sense to me. The accounts where I've seen, you know, the ones that I follow where I've seen this happen on Twitter, it seems like even the language that's being used has been simplified over time, where, you know, the folks who, when they were first getting started on Twitter, were posting, you know, these gems of information in complex language that would take a little bit of active engagement to read. Now that they have a lot of followers, it seems like the tweets have devolved into simpler language that's much easier to consume, but I would say is much vaguer in terms of its meaning or impact, and definitely resembles that fortune cookie-like state that Eugene Wei describes.
And I think we could contrast that to Snapchat, which also has some growth problems like Twitter does. Ben Thompson, the author of Stratechery, has said that Snapchat is like your phone and Facebook is like the phone book. The phone book has a ton of utility and the phone is much more personal. And the way people use Snapchat is very different than the way people use Facebook or Twitter. Basically, Eugene proposes that Snapchat's invisible asymptote is that it's not about features. It's actually being a generational divide. Snapchat is a place for young people and young people flock to it because they need a place to form like a new identity. And the fact that Snapchat is ephemeral helps that. And he also purports, and I don't have any data on this, so I'm not 100% sure about this, that old people and young people use Snapchat differently. That older people use a lot of stories and younger people tend to do more one-to-one or one-to-many messages. Either way, Snapchat can't necessarily be gamed in the same way that Twitter and Facebook can. It doesn't necessarily lead to more fortune cookie posts or outrageous trolling. But that doesn't mean that they don't have this same problem of hitting this asymptote. Maybe it is just a place for young people, and trying to get old folks on is just going to drive the young people away.
Right. If the point is that Snapchat is a part of your identity as a social media user, and that identity has a generational divide, then diluting that identity with folks from other generations is just going to make you less likely to want to use it. So it seems like the proposal here is that the invisible asymptote is almost self-fulfilling. There's, you know, if they were to try to transcend it, it would kind of destroy the original product market fit that they established to begin with.
And I think we can contrast that with Instagram, which seems to just be growing and growing and growing with no end in sight. Basically, Instagram has co-opted, you know, one of the best features of Snapchat, which is stories. And Eugene makes the point that the content on Instagram actually lends itself super well to advertising, in as much as the stuff that people tend to post tends to be an advertisement for their own lives. And so if you see your friend at a fancy dinner or at a nice hotel or on a fabulous vacation, then seeing an advertisement for a fancy dinner or a fabulous vacation or a luxury item right next to it, it's not jarring at all. It's actually pretty native, right? So the question is there an asymptote for Instagram?
This is a tough one. One thing to think about is the perspective of a game. You know, we talked about that with respect to Twitter and Facebook. And I believe with Instagram, there are some similar mechanics, right? Because Instagram is also a distribution channel in a somewhat similar way to some of those other platforms. And the game is about getting likes or about getting, you know, some distribution on your photos. There was an article I read recently about you know, folks who are pretending to live a lifestyle sort of based on the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. Did you read this, Dave?
Is it the one about Nigerians and
yes,
the UK?
Yes, yeah, it's a, I don't remember the details clearly, but the fascinating thing to me was these were kids who, you know, did not have that kind of lifestyle at all, but were selling that lifestyle on Instagram, and it hit a chord. They found a pocket of distribution that they could exploit by, you know, creating, producing these very vivid pictures of this Wolf on Wall Street lifestyle, which, you know, people were consuming and liking. And eventually it led to, my understanding is it led to some deals for their Instagram feed to be monetized. You know, it's not clear what the game is there yet, but there does seem to be something to exploit if you can get the marketing right. One thing, though, that's interesting about Instagram is that this sort of exploitation is exactly why people consume Instagram. So even if the system is gamed, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an asymptote. The fact that people are using Instagram to market a certain way of lifestyle doesn't inherently make the platform less pleasurable to use.
Right. The question is basically, is there a limit to how much Instagram one person can consume? And especially if Instagram is becoming more and more about this self-advertising or even paid advertising in general, is there going to be some upper bound on how much of this content people are going to want to consume, whether that's as stories or as the photo feed? And I would offer, like, we haven't seen it yet. The people who are addicted to Instagram are like deeply, deeply addicted. And I'd be curious what the upper bound is there. If there, obviously there must be one. People have to go to school or go to work or hang out with their families, hopefully. But I doubt that we've hit it so far, and I doubt we're even really that close.
I would agree with that as well.
All right, so we've talked about the social media platforms. Let's talk about some other kinds of companies. Amazon has already solved their shipping problem with Amazon Prime. And Ben Thompson has wrote about this as well, that the fact that they're raising prices on Prime might signal that they think that there's more value to be extracted out of existing Prime subscribers versus trying to get more people to subscribe to Prime in the first place. So they're moving on to maybe their next asymptote. And Eugene suggests that it might be discovery, because Amazon is an amazing place if you know what you want. If you want a USB-C power adapter, like I was looking at this morning, you can get one. There's a zillion of them. They help you find it through reviews. There's paid advertisements to help you find the best one. And Amazon's pretty good at helping you compare different options. But if you don't know what you want, then Amazon is a pretty rough place to shop. Have you had this experience?
To me, it's something that comes up very often when I'm shopping for clothes for my children. I have young children, and because I buy everything on Amazon, I try to look for clothing for them on Amazon, and it is a completely subpar experience. It's pretty interesting also to place this adjacent to the product we just talked about, Instagram, where discovery is sort of the whole point of Instagram. You're discovering all these experiences that you might want to engage in, or these products that you might want to buy. With Amazon, if you don't know clearly what you want, if you just want sort of generically children's clothing, but you don't know, you don't have a SKU, or you don't have some very specific type of clothing that you're trying to buy, the number of products there are overwhelming, and it's not oriented around that browsing experience.
And you can compare that to going into a children's clothing store, whether it's one brand or a boutique or whatever. There's not going to be 10,000 kinds of onesies on the rack there. There's going to be a few, and you get to choose which one you like after touching it, looking at it, etc. It's a very different experience, and I think Amazon is trying to solve this now, but from my own experience and from talking to my wife and others, it doesn't seem like they're even close to cracking the browsing or discovery experience.
They've, to my knowledge, they've been trying for some time now, and they haven't been able to figure it out. They, for a while, were piloting. They might still be piloting these microsites, which would be oriented, say, around women's clothing, or, you know, like very fashionable line of shoes. And it wouldn't even be obviously branded as Amazon. You would use it, and, you know, perhaps ultimately the back end was powered by the same e-commerce backend that powers Amazon.com, but you wouldn't necessarily know it was Amazon. My thinking on this is that it may not be in their DNA, and it may be one of the fundamental barriers that they run into as a company. Building that sort of product is very different than building the long tail product search engine. It's something that, you know, I definitely have dealt with in a prior life when I was at a startup called Octopart. Octopart was a search engine for electronic parts, and we totally went the long tail route. There are over 30 million SKUs, and so over 30 million unique products in the electronic parts world. One of the ways that we were able to distinguish the product was by trying to catalog all of them. So you could find anything that you wanted on that search engine if you knew the SKU. It was clear at a certain point that there was a lot of value in addressing the discovery problem, and there are certain models we had in mind for a good discovery experience in this world. The site that always came to mind was one called McMaster Car. If you go to that site, you'll see that it's completely oriented around browsing. It may seem odd to have a site that's oriented around browsing something like electronic parts, but it's actually a pretty pleasurable experience to do sort of this graphical, more whimsical kind of mode of discovery. We were never able to figure that out with Octopart. I think it's a pretty fundamentally different type of product search than the kind that Amazon is doing.
Absolutely. And it's going to be interesting to see if they can crack that over the next few years.
Definitely.
To continue this crazy growth trajectory that they're on.
Definitely. I mean, if anyone can do it, it's probably them.
Let's talk about Zillow.
Right. So Zillow is potentially a boring company to some folks in our community, but it's made some really fascinating moves lately. Its history, most people are probably aware of. They aggregated selling data, buying data, by kind of going with the go-between between sellers and buyers in the housing market, the brokers. So they, at one point, were able to aggregate sort of all three sides of that market, sellers, brokers, and buyers. They have a ton of people using their site, looking for homes, listing their homes to sell to potential buyers, and they monetize everything via ads. This is a public company, right? This is a huge company. The most fascinating thing that has happened in the last month or two with respect to them is they just completely pivoted their business model. I think this is extremely unusual for a public company. Now, instead of monetizing via ads, and instead of addressing all three sides of their market, they're essentially disintermediating brokers by becoming a broker. They're getting in the business of buying and selling homes. So I'll just read a little bit of the press announcement that CNBC covered when Zillow announced this. Zillow CEO Spencer Raskoff said, "We're entering that market and think we have huge advantages because we have access to the huge audience of sellers and buyers. After testing for a year in a marketplace model, we're ready to be an investor in our own marketplace." So that's the CEO saying, notice how he said sellers and buyers, did not mention brokers. That's the CEO putting it out there that they're going to completely change their business model to this marketplace model, and they will be the go-between. They're looking to replace brokers. So it's interesting to think about this from the perspective of invisible asymptotes.
What was the invisible asymptote there?
It seems clear that they were able to capture a lot of intent, right? They essentially aggregated sellers and buyers. My guess, reverse engineering what's happened here, and also thinking about it from the perspective of the whole market where you have these new players coming online like Open Door that are already from the ground up embracing this model, they were finding that they had hit a wall of growth, and the next thing that sellers really wanted was they didn't just want to list their homes on a site and have that data distributed via Zillow. They want to just sell their home as soon as possible. And buyers, they don't want to browse for homes on Zillow and then connect with a broker, go to an open house, and engage in all of this paperwork through a broker. They just want to buy homes ASAP with some price efficiency. So that was almost certainly the invisible asymptote that Zillow was running into. And I think it's a really smart move to try and move past it by becoming the broker.
Yeah, it's a pretty gutsy move from a public company to say, we hit a wall here. We could probably still be profitable, but we won't achieve the growth that we want by continuing our current model. So we're just going to go ahead and disrupt ourselves before we get disrupted by somebody else.
It seems like the only way they could possibly survive.
Pretty cool.
The next company that we wanted to talk about is probably the one that has blown past these invisible asymptotes at a similar rate to Amazon, Netflix. And you can kind of get a sense for all of their invisible asymptotes by looking at their product history and thinking about how they've moved up the stack of content delivery and finally production. Netflix, of course, started with DVD rentals, and they cornered that market. I remember when they started, I was still going to Blockbuster to rent videos, and they had this completely crazy model, which, you know, folks at the time were mocking, of sending DVDs via the mail. It turns out that this was a really smart move because they were able to purchase those DVDs once and rent them out to many people. The marginal cost that they might have suffered in losing DVDs or them getting damaged was negligible. And they aggregated content watchers. They aggregated movie watchers. So what do you think was that invisible asymptote there?
The amount of content they had to share or to rent out?
I would say that the timeliness of hitting that asymptote is important too. At some point, DVDs became antiquated, and it wasn't just that folks wanted a large library of content. They also wanted to be able to get that content on demand. So there was a very clear point where Netflix started getting into streaming movies. And at that point, there was also a lot of mocking happening, from my recollection, that the cost of delivering this content via the internet was going to be too great. And it was a fundamentally different business model, which sounds very similar to what we just discussed with Zillow. The end result, though, is, does Netflix even rent out DVDs anymore? No, because...
I don't know, do they?
Maybe they do. But that is certainly not their primary revenue generating mechanism. Now they deliver everything online through streaming, and they have a huge library of great content.
And even the move to create great content was a somewhat disruptive move to themselves as well. So they had built their existing empire by licensing content from Hollywood studios and TV studios who had these back catalogs of movies that at the time they didn't care very much about. But Netflix used that back catalog to build a streaming library and then started adding their own shows on top.
Yeah, so now they've essentially become a production studio. They've produced a ton of original content, a ton of stuff that has won awards or, you know, gone viral essentially in this world. And they rival the likes of someone like Disney, who started out as a production studio and now appears to be backtracking and pivoting back into the Netflix model. Potentially because from the Disney perspective, their asymptote is they have the content, but they don't have a lock on the delivery mechanism that Netflix does, the on-demand streaming mechanism.
So I think that the key takeaway from this discussion on invisible asymptotes isn't just that, okay, we can look at five or six companies and talk about them. But for any product, it would be a helpful exercise to try to think, you know, what's the invisible asymptote that's looming off in the future? Is there something that's sitting out there that's going to prevent us from the growth that we want or need? I think that there's probably a couple different ways to approach it. You know, Eugene suggests doing customer surveys for people who are your customers, in addition to serving people who aren't your customers to figure out if there are pain points for people who have already adopted your product and people who have chosen not to adopt your product. So I think this is something that could be applicable to product management and product development across a wide range of industries and disciplines. And again, it's definitely worth checking out the article if you have a chance. It's in the show notes. And Harish, anything more you want to add on this one?
No, just want to echo that you should definitely check that article out.
And we were going to cut this off before we hit the invisible asymptote of your attention to our podcast.
Jensen Harris, a longtime Microsoft product leader and current CTO of startup Textio, posted a tweetstorm regarding four thoughts about better MVPs. Here it is. The minimum viable product, or MVP, is the most well-known, admired concept in early startup product development. Unfortunately, MVP is often misused in a way that actually harms early-stage startups, leading them to create needlessly bad products. Four thoughts about better MVPs. 1. MVP doesn't automatically mean ship a bad UI. The word MVP can end up being used as a battering ram against people who argue to flesh out the product design more, to make the user experience more complete. Instead, the bare bonesness itself becomes a badge of honor. The key misunderstood word in MVP is viable. Eric Ries writes about this pretty clearly. Simplifying, you want to, in the quickest possible way, get to a product you can learn from, and then measure if your users are finding value in it. Only then should you invest more in the idea. Here's the thing, though. Sometimes the viability of an idea depends on it being delightful. The actual inherent elegance of a product, and the visceral emotional feeling people get when they use it, has a huge impact on how successful that product will be. For some products, it's absolutely true that good UI is not an important aspect of assessing product market fit. And, in those cases, definitely just do whatever's fastest. But in more cases than we care to admit, the choice we make to keep using a product relates to how it feels. The difference between a delightful to-do list app that climbs the App Store charts and one that fails to attract users is not mostly defined by feature set. It's defined by how it feels to use. Measuring the core viability of an idea like this requires a small, polished UI. 2, what MVP actually should mean is ship bad code. Okay, bad code is never an admirable goal in itself, but especially if you don't know whether your idea is going to work, every moment you spend creating the perfect architecture using the most elegant tech is likely wasted work. For most startups, focus only on what matters for MVP. A user experience that gives people a sense of the true soul of your product, and B, the telemetry code needed to measure what people are doing and how they feel using your product. Unless you are building a dev-focused product, those are the two key aspects of an MVP, not the code quality. The actual underlying code you can always fix later. Lots of time to do that once you have customers and funding and a bigger team. And yes, do fix it then. So many early-stage startups have failed with beautiful code. A fault-tolerant, elegantly architected and factored repo full of wonderfully documented code just as easily ends up deleted as the quick thing you put together that also didn't work. MVP isn't bad UI, good code. 3, make sure you're clear about what you're validating. As an example, consider the various virtual assistant scheduler bots that are all the rage right now. Several of them validated their market via contracting out assistant duties to real humans that pretended to be bots. What did they discover? That people really like having professional assistants to schedule meetings. Market validated, but Of course, we knew that already. There's a reason human assistants exist in the world. The hard part of the problem is replacing them with a computer. When you create an MVP, be really clear about what you intend to measure or learn and what actions you would take based on that. If you can't clearly state those things, then you probably aren't ready to build an MVP at all. Which leads to my final thought. Number 4, sometimes an MVP just isn't the right way to build. While the MVP concept has been incredibly successful for many teams, it isn't the only way to build software. Not all products can be assembled from a set of small, discrete, measurable, and independent features. Sometimes a big step forward requires the artistry and vision of a number of deep and interconnected features. And many times you don't know how the pieces come together until you've built some of it. The experimentation, the playing as you go, is the creative process itself. This is a risky way to build, for sure. If you are wrong and there's nothing there, you could waste months or even years of time. So, in place of MVP, figure out what are the go-no-go points along the way that determine whether you should continue building in a certain direction. It might be an intuitive sense of how all the pieces are coming together, using it with your own hands or within the team, and realizing that you're onto something special. It also needs to include bringing in outside customers or advisors to use and experience as you build. I learned from Steven Sinofsky the value of early outside feedback. We had an opportunity many times to show early work to brilliant people like Walt Mossberg and Get Thoughts. So often, people's first impressions, even at a very early stage, matched customers' eventual feedback. MVP has been an incredibly influential concept for startups. It's hard to argue with its success. So use it for good. Build a product with soul quickly and then validate it. But never compromise the product's soul. And remember, MVP is not the only way to build software.
That's all for Hacker Daily this week. Thanks so much for tuning in, for giving us a shot in this new format. We'd love to hear your feedback. Please reach out to us via email at info@hackerdaily.co. Or you can follow us on Twitter or DM us. Our handle is HackerDaily. And we'll be back next week with more stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend.